Hello, my name is Steve. Today is April, and I will be reading the New Yorker magazine from April 6th, 2026. The Spy Who Told All by David Kirkpatrick. Not long after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, Kevin Chalker set out to become a spy. He was a 30-year-old graduate student at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and he and his wife, Young, had a newborn son. She thought that this idea was terrible. Having grown up in a left-leaning Jewish family in Chicago, she pictured killings and coups. She also worried that Chalker would turn out like his father, a gruff and taciturn man who had once worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. He had ended up as a construction worker in Fort Worth, Texas, where he kept trying to interest his daughter-in-law in Jesus and guns. The last time the family got together, he'd offered to teach her how to use a knife to kill someone. Chalker reminded her that this father had been an enlisted Marine who joined a CIA paramilitary force operating in Southeast Asia during the early years of the Vietnam War, a time when, quote, the agency was doing wacky stuff all over the world, end quote. Chalker promised that he would do only traditional espionage, no big deal, adding, everything is going to be cool. He queued up a few days later at the CIA table at his school's national security job fair. Chalker had a more martial bearing than most graduate students. He had been a nationally ranked judo fighter and a Golden Gloves boxer in high school and college, and he had spent 2 years at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. He dropped out because of an eye injury sustained in a bar fight and eventually graduated from Texas Christian University. He also had an aptitude for languages. He could read and speak basic Mandarin and fluent Japanese. He had lived and worked in Japan for several years after college. He had even picked up a little Farsi from an Iranian-American girlfriend in college. A CIA analyst at the job fair put Chalker on the phone with a native Japanese speaker at headquarters to test his proficiency, and soon he was on the way to a Marriott in Northern Virginia for the first half of a dozen interviews. In the fall of 2003, he entered the first class of CIA trainees who had applied after 9/11. The training culminated in months at the farm, the legendary CIA base at Camp Peary in Virginia. The agency assigned each new trainee a randomly generated alias for internal use. Chalker became Fred E. Snappleton. I first heard of Chalker in 2018. After a six-year career in the agency, he had set up a security consulting company, and one of its few publicly known clients was the Emirate of Qatar. That spring, the investor, Elliot Broidy, a mega donor to President Donald Trump, filed a lawsuit calling Chalker a former CIA cyber operative and claiming that Qatar had paid him to orchestrate cyber attacks against Broidy and several others. The hacking and leaking of a vast trove of Broidy's private emails revealed that he had tried to turn the Trump White House against Qatar as part of his successful effort to win hundreds of millions of dollars in business with the United Arab Emirates, Qatar's chief regional rival, for a private intelligence company he owned. I wrote articles for the Times about the contents of Broidy's leaked emails, and I also covered his evolving legal claim against Chalker. I had no reason to doubt that Chalker had played a role in the hack. So I was surprised when in early 2024, Chalker sent me an email introducing himself. He had read an article I wrote for this magazine about an innocent American caught up in a spy versus spy battles among Persian Gulf monarchies, and he wanted to talk. We arranged to meet at his office high in the World Trade Center. Now 54, Chaka is nearly 6 feet tall and barrel-chested, with short brown hair and a thick, graying red beard. His suite in the World Trade Center is cavernous, with a view that sweeps from the Brooklyn Bridge to the Statue of Liberty. A collection of historic encryption machines is displayed in vitrines in the main room, and in his corner office, he keeps half-empty bottles of obscure liquors from around the world. The whole place could have accommodated dozens of people, but aside from a receptionist, he appeared to be alone. Chaka told me that his consulting firm, Global Risk Advisors, had once employed nearly 200 people, almost all of them former military and intelligence officers. Before Broidy's lawsuit, the company had earned about $100 million a year. By 2018, he had also founded a second company, Crypt, which develops cutting-edge quantum encryption, and hired dozens of computer programmers. But Broidy's suit received tremendous publicity, driving away all of Global Risk's clients, even the Qataris, and Chaka was forced to lay off its entire staff. Crypt had been negotiating its first large contract with the Pentagon until a counterintelligence official called about Broidy's allegations. Chaka virtually shut down that company, too, although he kept its name on the empty suite in the World Trade Center. Since then, Chaka said, he had not earned a single penny. He lost a lectureship at Yale after the Yale Daily News wrote about Broidy's lawsuit. Banks refused to do business with him. His insurance company had even canceled his homeowner's policy because he was deemed too great a risk. News reports, citing anonymous sources in Broidy's suit, alleged that Chaka had hacked various other eminent figures, including the Emirati ambassador to Washington, that he had spied on Switzerland's top prosecutor and two Republican senators, and that he had deployed such spy tricks as covert surveillance and honey traps, sexual lures, in order to help Qatar secure the rights to host the Soccer World Cup in 2022. Chaka, who denied all of these allegations, told me that the stress of Broidy's lawsuit made him vomit so frequently that he eventually required esophagus surgery. Recently, however, he and Broidy had settled the suit. Chaka told me that the terms were confidential, but that he wanted to repair his reputation. He had always been an American patriot, he insisted, and to prove it, he was willing to talk publicly for the first time about his years of clandestine work for the CIA, which, he said, had prevented Iran from getting a nuke. Chaka told me that, just as he had promised his wife, he had never personally engaged in combat or killing. Yet, during many conversations in the past 2 years, he also told me that he had risked his life for the agency and that he indirectly carried responsibility for some killings. He acknowledged that luck, right place, right time, had played a big role in the success of his various covert operations. But he also insisted that he had helped obtain pivotal information that laid the groundwork for more than a decade of American efforts to disrupt the Iranian nuclear weapons program. From the Stuxnet cyber attacks, which occurred around 2010, to the Obama administration's nuclear deal in 2015, to the U.S. airstrikes on Iranian atomic energy facilities in the summer of 2025. Chaka's strategy for clearing his reputation, which had been the foundation of his lucrative business, was unexpected, to say the least. It is nearly unheard of for ex-spies to divulge their past activities. But Chaka spoke in detail, aware that I would vet his narrative. As we talked, I sensed a certain resentment. The CIA, despite all the crucial and dangerous work he claimed to have done, had offered him no help as the lawsuit ruined his life. I wondered how much of his story I could trust. Chalker told me that his application to the CIA included an hours-long multiple-choice test. Instead of posing questions about geography or world affairs, the test asked him to tackle hypothetical situations, from the frustrating to the dangerous. Chalker concluded that the test was primarily assessing his psychology. Quote, "They don't want Boy Scouts," he told me. "They want people that just crazy enough to do all the crazy things the agency asks," end quote. He began as a clandestine services trainee on the East Africa desk at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Part of the desk's work at the time entailed paying favored Somali warlords to capture or kill suspected Al-Qaeda terrorists. Chalker told me, quote, "We would say $50,000 alive or $25,000 dead, because we preferred to have them alive so we could debrief them," end quote. He told me that one of his assignments was shipping dry ice to Mogadishu. The CIA used it to transport human tissue samples for DNA testing to confirm the identity of a corpse before paying a bounty. It isn't clear how many high-level targets, if any, were killed while Chalker worked on the East Africa desk, but the broader pattern of CIA payments to certain warlords was later exposed by a diplomat critical of the practice. The payments, intended to bolster warlords and clans who could counter Islamist extremism, helped set off a backlash in Somalia that culminated in an Islamist takeover in 2006. The U.S. responded by backing an Ethiopian invasion. Matt Bryden, an expert on the Horn of Africa, interviewed Mogadishu warlords who were on the CIA payroll at the time, and he told me that the payments had triggered, quote, "a whole claim of counterproductive consequences as far as the U.S. was concerned," end quote. Transportation in and out of Mogadishu was another problem for the agency. Armed groups had menaced CIA teams driving to and from neighboring Djibouti. Planes arriving in Mogadishu risked getting hit by gunfire as they descended. The desk chief asked Chalker for ideas. Chalker told me that by reading cable traffic and studying airplane tail numbers, he discovered that inbound charter flights delivering khat, a legal narcotic leaf that many Somalis chew for a buzz, always landed without trouble. When Chalker told me this story, he imitated the desk chief's throaty response. Quote, "Are you telling me that we are going to use U.S. taxpayer dollars to hire a bunch of effing drug dealers to fly in and out of effing Mog?" End quote. Then, quote, "That is the best effing idea I ever heard," end quote. The desk chief didn't respond to phone messages, but a former senior official told me that the CIA's inspector general questioned, but ultimately consented to, the reliance on cot shipment flights. I'm withholding certain names out of consideration for the agency's policies around protecting the identities of its officers. Elsewhere in this article, I have withheld details in order to protect individuals whose cooperation with the agency may put them in danger. After Chalker completed his assignment, he spent months learning defensive driving, the use of weapons, surveillance detection, nighttime land navigation, techniques to assess the credibility of a potential asset, and other tradecraft. Role-play exercises at the farm simulated traps or manipulations that officers might face. About a quarter of the class failed to complete the course, and Chalker told me that many others quit the agency within their first year of, quote, "being a spook in the real world," end quote. His class of more than 120 trainees eventually slimmed down to fewer than 50. At 33, Chalker was older than most of his classmates, with more experience professionally and abroad, and he was tapped to spend a day with James Pavitt, then the agency's director of operations. Other former officials confirmed that Pavitt, who died in 2022, sometimes invited trainees to join him for a day, though they stepped out during sensitive meetings. At the farm, graduation ceremony, envelopes labeled with the first name and last initial of each new officer were placed on a large table. Chalker told me that it was like finding your seat at a wedding. Inside were the officers' first assignments. Many were bound for Iraq, which the U.S. had recently invaded. Chalker assumed that, based on his language skills, he would work in East Asia. Instead, the slip inside the envelope for Kevin C. said, CP/IRANNUC, counter-proliferation working against Iran's nuclear weapons program. Chalker was shocked. A classmate with a doctorate in physics had been assigned to enter a 2-year Japanese language program, whereas Chalker, fluent in Japanese, had received a D in physics at the Air Force Academy and had never set foot in the Middle East. After a bus dropped the graduates off at Langley, he started to complain. The officer handling Chalker's assignment told him to, quote, go sit in that effing cubicle and don't speak until spoken to, end quote. Chalker told me that the officer happened to be Valerie Plame, whose cover had recently been blown by George W. Bush, by the George W. Bush administration, in a retaliatory leak that came after her husband publicly questioned the rationale behind the Iraq War. When I called Plame, she told me that she did not remember Chalker or use such profanities, but she said that she had been parked in a personnel job at the headquarters at the time and would indeed have rejected complaints about a trainee's assignment. Before 9/11, Iran's nuclear ambitions had been relatively low priority for American spies. The CIA knew that in the late 80s, Iran had bought instructions for making an atomic bomb from the Pakistani scientist A.Q. Khan at a meeting in Dubai. But Khan had sold outdated blueprints, and the agency believed that this had handicapped the Iranians, who had never engineered the necessary centrifuges. Then the invasion of Iraq. Although it turned up no evidence of a live threat from weapons of mass destruction, raised new concerns about how close Saddam Hussein had come in the 90s to obtaining a nuclear weapon. President Bush, alarmed, directed the National Security Council to prevent Iran from acquiring one. A debate over tactics unfolded within the Bush administration. Chalker told me that, as he understood it, the Pentagon had suggested running commando operations to kill key Iranian scientists, as Israel subsequently did. But the CIA proposed recruiting those scientists to defect, as U.S. spies had once courted Soviet physicists. Chalker paraphrased the agency's pitch. Quote, we can debrief them and learn so much more, and if they say no, then you can kill them, end quote. A more senior agency official confirmed the broad strokes of this account. The White House liked the agency's idea, and Bush authorized the CIA to conduct clandestine operations to stop Iran from building a bomb. The CIA program that Chalker described to me became publicly known in 2007 when the Los Angeles Times reported on the existence of an agency project called Brain Drain. But the details of the invitations to Iranian scientists had not previously been reported. The CIA, which jealously guards its sources and methods, declined to comment on Chalker's account. When Chalker joined the Iran desk, roughly 200 CIA officers there were working on counterproliferation. But nearly all of them were analysts. Aside from the group's chief and his deputy, only 3 others, including Chalker, were trained for field operations. I reviewed internal documents that independently confirmed these numbers. Chalker told me that there was an additional challenge. Both of the more experienced operators were undergoing treatment for alcoholism, a common problem in their profession. Just weeks after he graduated from the farm, Chalker became both the desk's newest case officer and the most senior one available. Chalker recalled that the group's chief had told him dryly, quote, "Snappleton, looks like you have a chance to excel," end quote. Chalker suspected that his premature promotion was a really, really bad idea. Chalker learned that the CIA didn't have a ready roster of Iranian scientists who might be persuaded to defect. In fact, the agency had few relevant assets inside Iran. About a decade earlier, however, a U.S. spy working in the region had obtained transformational insights from an Iranian nuclear physicist. This scientist, who was given the code name Bernadine, had even passed on detailed knowledge of the meeting in Dubai where the Iranians had bought the nuclear secrets from A.Q. Khan. But Bernadine had since become erratic. After refusing any payments for nearly a decade, he had suddenly demanded hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the information he provided increasingly confused CIA physicists. Some of it didn't even make scientific sense. Bernadine appeared to be useless, or worse, a potential double agent. Chalker was asked to come up with a plan to recruit other scientists, and began by reading old cable traffic about how the agency had handled Soviet defectors in the John Le Carré days. Then, just a few months after Chalker set to work, Bernadine called. Like other covert assets, he had been given a phone number at CIA headquarters to call if he wanted to talk or needed to be pulled out of Iran, along with a secret code and passphrase to authenticate himself. Bernadine was now viewed with such suspicion that Chalker's bosses suspected a setup. The unit's chief told Chalker to arrange a meeting with Bernadine outside Iran, but to consider the situation potentially hostile. If the Iranians had compromised Bernadine, their commandos might barge in to capture or kill Chalker. The night before, Chalker left to meet Bernadine in a European city. He thought that these might be his final hours with his family. His wife was pregnant with their second child. After dinner, their two-year-old offered him some of his ice cream because sharing is caring. The global war on terror was near its peak. Quote, "Everything was fast back then," end quote, Chalker recalls. The agency sent him to the meeting alone and unarmed. According to Chalker, this was standard. If a case officer needed a weapon, quote, "pretty much everything has already gone wrong," end quote. When he reached the European city, he identified Bernadine on a prearranged street corner. He was the older man standing alone with quivering hands. They exchanged code words. Chalker, quote, "it's always something like, I am looking for an Italian restaurant that serves lasagna. I don't eat Italian food, but I love apple pie," end quote. An operative would normally plan to walk alone to a hotel to avoid being seen with an asset. But in this case, the danger was that Bernadine might be conspiring to kidnap or murder Chalker. So he wanted bystanders to see them together. He escorted Bernadine through a nearby hotel lobby to a room he had reserved. As soon as the door closed, Chalker began hammering Bernadine with hostile questions. He recited details from the recent reports filed by Bernadine's CIA handler and demanded that Bernadine explain his suspicious behavior. Bernadine looked baffled. Nobody from CIA had ever treated him so disrespectfully. He said that he had never demanded any payments or taken any CIA money. He insisted that he began working with the agency to protect his children from a dangerous nuclear arms race, not to get rich. He also denied relaying the technical information that had so confused CIA physicists, calling it obvious nonsense. Chalker, unsure what to make of these denials, placed a notebook in front of Bernadine, who spent hours filling it with pages of new details and diagrams related to Iran's nuclear program. While Bernadine returned to Iran, Chalker took the next flight out of the country. A team of CIA officers detained Chalker at Dulles Airport. The agency was worried that he, too, might have flipped and made him take a polygraph test. But physicists at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee said that the new scientific details from Bernardine checked out. Chalker also judged him to be honest. This raised an obvious question. If Bernardine hadn't provided the bogus information or requested the payments, had his previous handler at the agency engaged in deception? Chalker later wrote a report accusing the handler of fabricating intelligence and embezzling from the CIA. Chalker said he had been told that the agency eventually recovered some $2 million in stolen funds and that the handler served time in prison. In the months after the meeting in Europe, Chalker arranged to sneak Bernardine's wife and several close family members out of Iran. He then set out to meet again with Bernardine, this time in a Middle Eastern city, with the plan of escorting him to the United States. Using encrypted communications, Chalker directed a CIA case officer in the city to set up a safe house for a rendezvous with Bernardine. When Chalker explained the plan to me, he taught me a lot of agency jargon. To pick up a key to the safe house, he set up a brush pass in the city's souk in a busy alley where he and the local case officer might make contact unobserved. This followed a protocol known as screening, cover, and flow. To spot the case officer, he asked her to describe her appearance and assigned her to carry both a fear recognition signal. Her FAR was a copy of the Financial Times, which is printed on distinctive pink paper, and a near recognition signal. Her near was a scarf tied around the forward strap of her purse slung over her left shoulder. If she suspected surveillance, she was to remove the scarf to abort the handoff. He also gave the case officer a specific SDR, or surveillance detection route, so that he could watch her arriving from an elevated spot and feel confident that nobody was tailing her. She showed up on time, yet she carried a different newspaper, and her scarf was tied to the wrong part of her purse strap in the back. Was this a signal or just sloppiness? Chalker panicked. He took the key, but he sent a message to Bernardine to stay in Iran and then hurried to the airport. Three security officers met him in Dulles. This time, a team of gray-haired CIA veterans grilled him about each step of this plan. Chalker wondered what he'd done wrong. Had the Iranians grabbed Bernardine? He interrupted his interrogation. I get it. I'm fired. Just tell me why and let me go home. In fact, the questioning of Chalker was part of a post-mortem examination of a misstep by the case officer who had handed him the key. She was married to a U.S. official working in the country, and she had rented the safe house using an alias, along with a fake passport. The country's intelligence officers had already been monitoring her, and upon reviewing the rental agreement, concluded that she was a spy. Not a very good one. She botched the newspaper and scarf signals. According to Chalker, the country's intelligence agency had shared the location of the safe house with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who likely would have abducted Chalker had he shown up. It's not clear how the CIA learned of this tip-off to the IRGC, but it was presumably through intercepted communications. Working with a different undercover officer, this time in a European city, Chalker successfully extracted Bernardine to America. A CIA cable with the subject heading Exceptional Performance Award for Fred E. Snappleton commended Chalker for, quote, exemplary ops sense in guiding the asset and his family during this sensitive time, end quote, and awarded him a $2,500 bonus. To find other potential defectors, Chalker asked Bernardine to name everyone he knew involved in the Iranian nuclear program. After 8 months, according to one internal count that I reviewed, Chalker's debriefings of Bernardine had produced hundreds of intelligence reports, as well as leads for several other operations, which in turn generated more successful defections. One pivotal source emerged under sordid circumstances. In 2006, Chalker was based in the CIA's New York station. He sometimes coordinated with the Department of Homeland Security to look out for targets passing through JFK, and he developed contacts inside the department's agencies. One day, Chalker's counterparts in DHS called with a tip. The local police in a town in Hudson Valley had received a complaint about an Iranian-born scientist allegedly soliciting prostitutes. FBI special agents told Chalker that he could join them as they questioned the man, and they all headed upstate. The scientist, Masood Naraghi, was about 70 years old. He had studied nuclear physics at the University of Michigan in the early 60s, finished a doctorate at Case Western Reserve University, then returned to Iran and worked for its Atomic Energy Agency. A short-lived marriage to an American woman had given him a green card, and he had quietly returned to his own to the United States in the early 90s, bringing with him a considerable amount of cash. He'd used the money to found an engineering firm, Tor International, just outside Newburgh, New York. Before Chalker and the FBI agent sat down with Naraghi at his Tor office, Chalker checked with CIA headquarters. He learned that other case officers had debriefed Naraghi years earlier and concluded that he did not know anything useful to the CIA about about Iran's nuclear program. But as Chalker listened to Naraghi answering the FBI's questions, he felt that the Iranians seemed too, quote, too smart to be playing so dumb, end quote. Impulsively, Chalker threw out Bernadine's real name and asked if Naraghi knew him. The scientist, quote, turned sheer white, end quote, Chalker said. He recalled thinking with delight, oh, you mother effer. Naraghi, whom the CIA codenamed Shelv, turned out to have been the founding father of the country's covert nuclear program, the J. Robert Oppenheimer of Iran. But he was no loyalist. Chalker concluded that Naraghi had embezzled from the Iranian government to build up the nest egg he used to found Tor. It took Chalker 2 years of empathetic listening and confident reassuring to convince Naraghi to cooperate fully. But in time, Naraghi shared new insights about how Iran had overcome the weaknesses in AQ Khan's blueprints, and about the scale and scope of the country's nuclear ambitions. An internal CIA document recommending Chalker for another award said that Naraghi had provided new intelligence reporting stream on the foundations of Iran's desire to become a nuclear power. As they talked, Naraghi decided that he wanted to write a memoir about his career and defection. The agency envisioned the book as a public invitation for other Iranian nuclear scientists to defect as well. And Chalker worked government contacts at the Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation to line up a publisher at its HarperCollins division. But News Corporation executives somehow directed Chalker to Daniel Halpern, the bushy-haired and left-leaning editor of the company's literary imprint Echo Press. When I called Halpern, he readily admitted that he was quite suspicious of the CIA and said that he vividly remembered Chalker's visit to his office. Chalker and another officer had been, quote, right out of central casting. Everybody on the floor could tell they weren't your usual offers, end quote. And the whole project felt very, quote, cloak and dagger, end quote. Halpern told me that he ultimately decided that Naraghi was unwilling to reveal enough for a commercially viable book. Still, a member of the Naraghi family told me that Masood, who died in 2020, left behind a completed manuscript. The family declined to share it with me and is now seeking to sell it to a new publisher. To recruit an asset, most undercover CIA case officers follow a method referred to during training as SADRH, for spot, assess, develop, recruit, and handle. The painstaking process might take years. Chalker's job had a different rhythm. He specialized in the cold pitch, recruiting a stranger in minutes. Perhaps a relative living in the West agrees to lure a scientist outside Iran, or an eminent physicist invites an Iranian to speak at a conference abroad. The CIA often set up conferences for that purpose. Chalker, posing as a curious junior researcher, might arrange to bump into the scientist in a hallway and ask a question about his long-ago dissertation. Could they get coffee? Chalker said that, at least for him, the curious scientist ruse never worked. He told me that every actual scientist he approached immediately guessed that he was a spy from either the U.S. or Israel. Quote, every time I walked up and say, Salam Babibi, how are you? They just think, oh, this is it, and they assume I am there to kill them, end quote. Most of the time, he said the terrified scientist was compliant enough to at least sit down in a cafe. Chalker typically had about 10 minutes to explain as gently as possible that he was from the CIA and that he had the power to secure the scientist and his family a comfortable new life in the U.S., and that if the offer was rejected, the scientist, regrettably, would be assassinated. Chalker tried to emphasize the happier potential outcome. Killing a civilian scientist would violate international law. The American government has denied ever doing it, and I found no evidence that the U.S. has carried out any such murders. A former senior agency official familiar with the brain drain project told me all that mattered was the Iranian scientists had believed they would be killed, regardless of whether the U.S. actually made good on the threat. And Israel had been conducting a campaign to assassinate Iranian scientists, which made the prospect of lethal reprisal highly plausible. Other former officials with knowledge of the project told me that the CIA sometimes shared intelligence with Mossad, which enabled its operatives to locate and kill a scientist. Such information exchanges were kept vague enough to preserve deniability if more legalistic U.S. administration later took office. According to Ronan Bergman's Rise and Kill First from 2018, A History of Israel's Targeted Killings, Michael Hayden, Bush's last CIA director, told then-President-elect Barack Obama that the Israeli assassinations program, quote, has no American relationship whatsoever, end quote, and that the agency would, of course, never recommend such a thing. But Hayden continued his, quote, broad intelligence judgment, quote, was that the Israeli killings were very useful because, quote, the death of those human beings had a great impact, end quote, on deterring Iran from developing a bomb. The Iranian news media has blamed the deaths of at least 18 scientists in the past 2 decades on Israeli and American spies. Israeli officials have done little to hide Mossad's role in the assassinations, many of which were carried out with the assistance of internal Iranian opposition groups. In 2007, Ardeshir Hosseinpour, a physicist in his mid-40s, was killed in Isfahan earlier by radiation or by poisonous gas. In 2010, a bomb planted on a parked motorcycle in Tehran killed Musad Ali Mohammadi, who was 50. Later that year, a bomb affixed to the car of Majid Sarahatyari, another scientist in his mid-40s, killed him and injured his wife. In 2011, gunmen on motorcycles shot and killed Dariush Razanijad, age 35, as he and his wife were picking up their daughter from school. His wife was also wounded. In 2012, yet another bomb affixed to a car killed 32-year-old Mostrada Ahmadi Roshan, along with his driver, and so on. Chalker told me that he didn't know the exact fates of the scientists who refused his offers. This wasn't surprising, given that intelligence agencies compartmentalize information about sensitive operations. Citing stories from friends in the U.S. Special Forces, Chalker said he believed that, on at least a few occasions, U.S. commandos, such as Delta Force operatives and Navy SEALs, or members of the CIA's paramilitary ground branch, had carried out targeted killings of Iranian military officers. Chalker said the operators even had a term of art for such killings, X-boxing. He could not name any Iranian scientists assassinated by Americans, but he is confident that those who rebuffed him were in fact killed, one way or another. Israel's assassination campaign sometimes complicated Chalker's attempts to recruit defectors. He told me that an Iranian scientist who had agreed to cooperate with him, codenamed Hustle, once casually mentioned that he was considering an invitation from a colleague outside Iran to attend a conference abroad. Surmising that Mossad must be trying to draw Hustle out of Iran in order to kill him, Chalker wrote out an urgent cable for the CIA to send to the Israelis, taking the exceptional step of disclosing himself in his operation. He summarized the cable to me, quote, "You do not have dibs, and we do not, I repeat, do not kill the white guy about 5'11 with brown hair and a red beard who may be with him," end quote. Hustle eventually defected to the U.S. via a city in Asia. According to an internal CIA report, Hustle participated in, quote, "an intense week-long debrief session," end quote, with specialists from the CIA and the Department of Energy, and provided detailed re-engineering schematics of Iran's most advanced and sensitive nuclear technologies, along with the locations of clandestine facilities within the missile development node of Iran's weaponization program. Chalker and a CIA lawyer persuaded a university administrator to ask a member of its physics family to assess Hustle's qualifications to enroll in graduate school. Hustle went on to complete a degree in the U.S. and started a successful new career. I independently confirmed those aspects of his resume. Chalker told me that two of the scientists he had approached outside Iran, complete dicks who were very confrontational, had brusquely rebuffed him. He was certain that they had immediately reported him to the Iranian intelligence. In both instances, he raced to an airport. He was also sure that both men were eventually killed, though he felt little remorse about it. Each scientist had made a choice to side firmly with Iran in a covert war with the U.S. at a time when Iranian-backed militias were actively killing American soldiers in Iraq. The Pentagon has said that more than 600 Americans died at the hands of such Iranian proxies. Another scientist was tantalized enough by Chalker's offer to help him defect that he talked for more than 2 hours. But the scientist worried that the CIA could not fulfill its promise to protect his wife and children from the Iranian authorities. Chalker told me that he had insisted, quote, "No, I can do this. I've done this so many times before. You don't understand. And you know, you are going to die if you don't let me do this," end quote. The scientist still refused, telling Chalker, quote, "If I say yes, they might die. And if I say no, only I will," end quote. Chalker told me that he felt really bad about that one. The scientist in question felt no loyalty to the Iranian government and indeed would have been happy to help defeat its nuclear program. He was sacrificing himself to protect his family. Quote, "My only job was to make them feel secure and safe, to get them to agree to let me take them out," end quote, Chalker told me. Quote, "I just couldn't convince him," end quote. Another Iranian scientist, whose code name was Ejection, had started out even more skeptical. At their initial meeting, Ejection clung to the conviction that Chalker was a Mossad operative trying to lure him to his death. To establish the CIA bona fides, Chalker told me, he began, quote, "peeling the onion," end quote. First, he named the other Iranian scientists, including close former colleagues of Ejection's. whom he had helped to defect with their families. Then Chalker pulled from a hidden compartment in his jacket a photograph of himself in the U.S. standing next to one of those colleagues. When that didn't work, Chalker produced a note from another such colleague, handwritten in Farsi, urging Ejection to trust Chalker's offer. Finally, Chalker repeated a detail of Ejection's medical history that only his good friends would have known. But Iranian authorities had told Ejection that the Israelis had killed all of the former colleagues Chalker claimed to have recruited. He remained convinced that everything Chalker said was part of a Mossad plot. The Israelis could have staged the photograph using a mask or wax dummy, and they could have tortured a colleague into writing something in Farsi, then digitally manipulated the letters to form a fake message. They could have hacked Ejection's medical records. Giving up, Chalker left Ejection a phone number to call if he changed his mind before he was killed. Not long afterwards, in Iran, Ejection unexpectedly ran into the daughter-in-law of one of those former colleagues. Defying Chalker's warnings, she had flown into the country to visit her extended family. Another member of that family confirmed to me that they had returned to Iran for such visits. In Chalker's telling, Ejection offered the woman condolences about her father-in-law's assassination by Mossad. She said, "Not to worry, he's alive and living in the U.S. under the protection of a burly CIA officer with short brown hair and a red beard." Ejection, convinced at last, called the number Chalker had left him. More than 2 years after their abortive encounter, Chalker sat down again with Ejection in another hotel room in a European city and congratulated him on the new life awaiting him in the U.S. Chalker was joined by a CIA translator and by a physicist from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory who debriefed Ejection for 3 days. Ejection turned out to have access to Natanz in central Iran, where a secret facility had been equipped with underground buildings capable of housing thousands of centrifuges for enriching uranium. He knew much more than expected. By the second day, a cable from headquarters informed Chalker that the plan had changed. Instead of flying Ejection to America to start that new life, Chalker was told to persuade him to return to Iran to find out even more. Improvising, Chalker seized on a professional insecurity that he knew haunted Ejection. Chalker told me that his pitch went like this. Ejection was a star scientist with a prodigious intellect, but he had never been promoted to the level he felt his work merited. Surely the Iranian system had been unfair to him. Chalker recalls telling Ejection, quote, "People have never treated you with the respect you deserve. But this is your chance. You can prove to everyone that you are smarter and better than they are," end quote. For Ejection, returning to Iran meant risking his life. He said that he would go back only if the CIA paid him hundreds of thousands of dollars. Chalker, as it happened, had brought along a duffel bag containing $3 million, but he knew the byways of the Iranian culture and worried that Ejection would stop trusting him if he coughed up the money without haggling. Chalker talked him down to about $10,000, in part by explaining that carrying more cash would make him too conspicuous at the airport. "Sometimes," Chalker told me, "a case officer's job is to convince someone that something is a really good idea, even though it's actually the worst idea ever." Ejection agreed to return to Iran for a short period. Chalker, who handed him off to another case officer, never learned where he ended up or whether he survived. Another cable to Fred E. Snappleton commended Chalker for giving the agency invaluable eyes and ears on the ground inside the towns. According to Chalker, another scientist codenamed Sea Lion provided new intelligence about a Syrian weapons program. An asset codenamed Omitted added more details during a meeting in the Middle Eastern city and then returned to Syria. Not long afterwards, Israel bombed a facility where Omitted was believed to be working, and Chalker told me that he was unsure if Omitted was killed. Former CIA officials told me that intelligence reports from Chalker's assets were presented to the highest levels of the U.S. government, including Presidents Bush and Obama. In the course of my reporting, I met several enemies Chalker had made over the years, sometimes in disputes over money. When I pressed him about the anonymous former employees, he admitted that he had been a hot-tempered and secretive boss, and that Global Risk's work culture, dominated by former spies and commandos, had been characterized by what he called toxic masculinity. Turnover was high, and he readily named a few employees who had left on bad terms and might have seen a chance to profit by cooperating with Broidy. After all, Broidy's private intelligence company, Circinus, hires the same kinds of former spies and commandos that Chalker's once did. In that sense, Broidy and Chalker, one working for the UAE and the other for Qatar, were two of a kind. As Broidy's lawsuits dragged on, the allegations it kicked up grew increasingly far-fetched. The AP reported obtaining business proposals that Chalker had supposedly submitted to Qatar. Fox News, the Free Press, and two Swiss news outlets eventually posted some of this material online. One putative proposal, titled Project Endgame, evidently used Endgame as a code name for the Emirati ambassador to Washington, Youssef al-Otaiba, printed on Global Risk letterhead dated March 2017 and signed only with the initial K. It appeared to outline a plan backing Otaiba's emails, hacking Otaiba's emails, which leaked later in that spring. But the proposal was full of cartoonishly goofy faux spy talk. Imminent threat. Qatar's enemies are already plotting against you. The time to act is now. And it looked less like an authentic pitch to officials in Doha than like a document calculated to embarrass Qatar and the West. As an attack on Hamas is an attack on Qatar, an attack on the Muslim Brotherhood is an attack on Qatar. Echoing right-wing conspiracy theories, the proposal also offhandedly listed the Times as among Qatar's media assets. John Cipher, a prominent former CIA officer who reviewed some of the supposed proposals as a potential expert witness for Chalker, told me that the documents were loopy and horseshit and that they could not have been written by anyone with actual U.S. government experience. The Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the BBC never reported on the documents or their allegations. Chalker himself had never been a cyber operative. In any case, it would have been hardly require the expertise of a former CIA officer to carry out the run-of-the-mill phishing attacks that snared both the ambassador and Broidy. Nor, I learned, did Chalker stop working for the agency after resigning. Several former officers told me that Chalker had become a contractor for the agency and for the Pentagon. Global Risk had provided the CIA with covert financial and logistical services for operations around the world. People familiar with Global Risk's operations told me that the Gibraltar shell companies had been used to move the CIA money and that much of Chalker's revenue had come from covert work for the U.S. government. Chalker had stayed in contact with the deputy chief of CIA station Doha while working for Qatar and had obtained a State Department license to provide the training and services that Global Risk sold to the country. Powell Chudzki, whose law firm handled the licenses for Global Risk, told me that the State Department had conducted an inquiry in response to the Associated Press article and identified no violations of law. Indeed, given how much money Chalker was making off the CIA and the military, I found it hard to imagine that he would jeopardize his cash flow by hacking Broidy, a prominent Republican fundraiser close to Trump, much less by spying on senior American lawmakers. Finally, on April 2, 2024, a magistrate judge gave Broidy's lawyer a one-month deadline to justify the supposed safety concerns of the former Global Risk employees, veterans of the Special Forces or the CIA, who presumably knew how to look out for themselves. 6 days later, Broidy settled. Four people familiar with the terms told me that no money changed hands. Chalker faced no criminal charges. Senior national security officials do not appear to have taken the allegations seriously either. While the lawsuit was unfolding, Crypt, Chalker's other company, signed technology licensing agreements with both the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Los Alamos National Laboratory. Regardless of the merits of Baroudi's lawsuit against Chalker, it effectively doubled as an attack on Qatar by portraying the country as involved in seedy digital espionage. The resulting negative publicity increased the perceived tasks for U.S. consulates, lobbyists, and former officials who might have considered working for Qatar, scaring them off or causing them to raise their prices. All of this surely pleased Qatar's rival, the UAE and Saudi Arabia. The email leaks revealed that Baroudi had sought lucrative contracts with both countries. Still, Chalker is no innocent. Marko Milanovic, a professor at the University of Reading in Britain, is an expert on international law, told me that the killing of Iranian nuclear scientists in peacetime, whether by Israel or by the United States, was just murder, just killing someone you don't like. Imagine, he said, if Russia or Iranian spies killed American computer scientists merely because they were working on artificial intelligence or it had a military application. Of course, a former spy complicit in such killings was not a legitimate target either. But Milanovic said, if Chalker's recent difficulties, I am going to cry, you a river? No, end quote. I asked Chalker about this perspective, and to my surprise, he said that he could see parallels between his activities as a spy and Baroudi's lawsuit against him. Quote, it was a highly successful nation stats denial and disrupt campaign. Just look at what it cost me, physical and mental health. Lost friendships, lost business, end quote. He concluded, quote, I have to admit, they did a bang-up job.